The Guardian.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace. From the unusual to the extraordinary, your website stands out when you build it with Squarespace. Start your free trial today. Visit squarespace.com/Guardian. Hello and welcome to the Guardian Books podcast. This week we feature a Guardian Book Club event with an author who needs little introduction. Bill Bryson won the hearts and minds of the British public 20 years ago with his seminal book, Notes from a Small Island, in which he gave us a tour around the newly adopted country he loves so dearly to explore, admire, pick apart, and sigh deeply at. Filled with observational humour and infused with exasperated yet helpless love, the American-born author appears to have connected so accurately with the essence of Britain in the late 20th century that he was nominated in a BBC poll as the person we think best represents Britain. His new and most recent book, The Road to Little Dribbling, revisits our small island and gives us an updated view on manners, mediocrities, and the M25. Here he joins John Mullen and a live audience to talk about the writing of Notes from a Small Island and how much has changed.
I suppose I wanted to start, Bill, by doing my sort of literary academics question, if you don't mind, get it out of the way, which is not so much the what it's about as to the how it's written, because I'm always so fascinated with travel books or books about journeys, when the writing happens, actually, and how the writing happens. And Notes from a Small Island has some extremely detailed vignettes in it. Who can forget that guest house room in Llandudno? Are you writing it every night or something while you're travelling?
Well, by this stage of my career, I wasn't doing it so much. When I first started out, because I had no idea how to write travel books, and I found I was actually sitting somewhere, like a cafe in Stockholm or something, and I found myself writing in a book, spent morning writing in a book. And I thought, this is crazy, because that's all I'm doing is taking notes. I'm not actually having the experiences. So from that point, I thought, no, what I will do is I will have the experiences, and I will take a lot of photographs, driving down a highway and just holding the camera out the window, just to sort of aid memoir. But mostly I would leave it to memory, which is a fairly risky strategy, but it means that you're not distracted very much along the way by just trying to take notes. So the only things I tend to take notes on, or have historically took notes on, were things like inscriptions on gravestones, or something that I might have heard on the radio, or a plaque that I saw. Now, of course, you can just take a photograph of these things. It's much, much quicker and easier. And then for the rest, I leave it to my memory. And I have to say, I discover all the time how faulty, to my astonishment, how faulty my memory is. I was just in Durham, and with the new book, I wrote there's a part in the book where I actually thought I saw a child drowning in the River Weir. Years ago, I looked over the edge of a bridge, and I've described it in the new book perfectly faithfully. I remember this experience very, very vividly because of what it was. The kid didn't. There was a little toddler, and he was fished out. He was fine. But for a moment, I thought, I'm watching a little boy drown, and I'm up on this high bridge, and there's nothing much I can do about it other than shout. So it was seared into my memory as about as powerfully as any recent experience could be. And I was just back in Durham this weekend for a reading there, and I went on Elvet Bridge, the bridge on which it happened, and I looked over the edge, and it's nothing like. It's quite different from the way I remembered it. And I'm sure that if you took me back to all of these places, not least Notes from a Small Island, I would find that there's so many things that are profoundly different from the way I remember them.
You haven't had, because there are particular exchanges, conversations, particularly with the owners of guest houses and things. You haven't been challenged by any of those individuals the veracity or accuracy of...
No, on the whole, no. A lot of people claim to be the people that I've met somewhere along the way, and are not.
I'm Mrs. Smegma.
Yeah, yes. But it's very strange where people think... it's hard to understand what people are thinking, but no, on the whole, people have not challenged me for the things I've written in books.
And this, when you... when you did the journey, when you wrote the book, it was a kind of valedictory thing. Yes, you were leaving. But I noticed, I mean, I don't know if this was a sort of hedge against future decisions, but there's a rather prescient passage in Mfanwy's restaurant in Blanau Fastiniog. Do you remember this? I
remember the restaurant, the cafe.
I would say it's a characteristic sort of Bryson scene in that it's raining, everything's closed. I mean, you will know one of the great themes of Notes from a Small Island is how everything is always closed all the time. So everything is closed except this restaurant, I think. You're sitting in there and you've got sort of, I don't know, 4 hours or something to wait for the next train. Another topic, writ large, the sort of the vagaries of public transport. And you say this, I watched the rain beat down on the road outside and told myself that one day this would be 20 years ago.
I'd forgotten that line, but yes, there is a certain comfort. I mean, I've had that experience where thinking that you know, as I'm lying injured in a road or something, or something terrible is going on, thinking this at least will make good material for the next book, or one day this will be a memory. There's always a certain amount of comfort in that. Yeah, so.
One of the fascinations for it for me is the sort of, I mentioned it already, I wanted to ask about it. Is guest house the right word? Sometimes they're hotels, sometimes they're more like B&Bs. The places you stay, I mean, you seem to me to be a connoisseur of the English guest house, and sometimes a very appreciative one. I mean, one of the, well, you know, I have slightly a horror of English guest houses, hotels. It's no accident that the great kind of comic anatomy of British ailments is Fawlty Towers about a hotel, but you seem to have a certain fondness for these
places.
I do
like them, and at the time I was doing Notes from a Small Island, they had improved immensely, because of course when I'm talking in the book about the Mrs. Smegmas in Dover and that kind of thing, the nightmare experiences that I had, those were in the 70s, the very first time I came over here. By the 90s, when I was traveling around for Notes from a Small Island, guest houses had become much, much more comfortable and accommodating and not quite as good as they are now. I mean, we're so, you know, now you wouldn't go anywhere near a guest house that didn't have a little color television in the room and all kinds of comforts and en-suite facilities and all of that. But they were pretty good then, and they were reasonable. And I always felt that I was somehow connecting more with society somehow. I mean, it was just something better than just being less distancing than being in a hotel.
And that thing that's in the title, Notes from a Small Island, the smallness, obviously, I think a lot of British people, it doesn't really strike them because they're only used to living in a small place. But obviously, if you come from the Great Plains, it's very, very striking. And it seems like smallness is kind of quite integral to your experience of what kind of Britain is like.
Yeah, I really do. I write about this in the new book, in fact, but I've touched on it various times over the years. I do think Britain is a perfect size, and I think that is something that people don't reflect upon very much. But I mean, it's perfect size in that you've got enough people to have a critical mass that you can have a completely independent culture. If all the rest of the world vanished tomorrow, there would still be, you know, you'd still have good theater and novels and good surgeons and good universities and all the things that any society ought to provide in a way that smaller countries couldn't necessarily provide. The world would be diminished, obviously, if several billion people vanished, but Britain would still keep it, be a nice core of culture going on. But at the same time, Britain, because of its smallness, its compactness, there is a coziness about it, a kind of familial quality to all of it, that wherever you are in the country, when you turn on the news, you know, we're all watching Fiona Bruce or Hugh Edwards or whatever, but it's lots of shared experiences. Those of us who listen to Radio 4 and wherever you are in the country, we're all having that kind of shared experience. And that is entirely as a consequence of it being small. In a country the size of the US or Australia, you cannot get that. People in New York are not really going to be having the same experiences as the people in California.
It's also, it's a striking fact about, especially when you're actually walking on the bits of both Notes from a Small Island and your new book, when you're walking, that I suppose, as a Brit, one of the pleasures, alongside the rueful recognition of national woes, one of the pleasures is the recognition that it might be quite unusual to live somewhere where, say, I don't know, in those of you who haven't read it, one day Bill's walking in a bit of the New Forest And within a very short distance, there's Arthur Conan Doyle's grave, the place where William II maybe was killed by an arrow, and the house where Alice Liddell, who's Alice in Wonderland, lived. And, you know, and bang, 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 and you encounter these kind of things all the time in a very densely packed way.
Well, it is, but that is Britain. I mean, that is one of the most astonishing things about it. It's just, you know, if you had the same, if you did nationally, had blue plaques the way you have them in London, they would be everywhere. I mean, they would just be absolutely everywhere. If you were parachuted randomly into this country, I can guarantee that wherever you landed, you would be within a couple of miles of things that are really important, globally important, consequential, that have changed history in some way or have certainly enriched the world culturally, or, you know, the birthplace of a great poet or a famous playwright or something like that, or an artist. So, I mean, wherever you are, there's stuff everywhere. I mean, even you were just telling me today that you live in this, or grew up in a tiny village in Wiltshire that nobody's ever heard of, but William Hazlitt was from there. I mean, everybody in the room will have something like that. Wherever you're from, you've got some famous person. All we had in Iowa, the whole state of Iowa, was we had the guy that played Fred Mertz on I Love Lucy.
I remember him, though. But you've also got, I'm sure you weren't calculating on this, but you've also got what your publisher must have slowly begun to realise as a fantastic sort of selling point for the book, which is for many readers, like myself, as I was saying to you in the green room, the Notes on a Small Island, I've been to all these places. I mean, there are one or two I haven't been to, but I haven't been to Thurso. But I've got a really good friend who comes from Thurso.
Do you so really?
Yeah. But, you know, that's, I mean, it's very attractive to readers because for all sorts of other reasons. But maybe you couldn't have written a travel book about America that every American would have been so familiar with such a proportion of the places that you...
There's no way. I mean, because of the scale of America. And most people, you find most people on the coasts have only the sketchiest idea of what happens between the coasts, and they just they really have no idea. I mean, it's not uncommon at all for people. You know, I come from Des Moines. Somebody had to. I come from Des Moines, and it's not at all hard to find people who in America who mispronounce it. You know, even though it's one of the state capitals. You're dealing with a completely different scale there. So Britain is, you know, it's very crowded with incident and achievement and lots of stuff. It really does feel infinite to me. I mean, I will never run out of things to see and do here. It's just never going to happen. But at the same time, it is really embraceable in a way. And I think those two things are a very big part of why I stay here.
It's really interesting rereading it because I first read it quite a long time ago. And then I reread it recently, and I hadn't noticed the first time I read it that you actually seem to have with you a copy of another book by an American traveling around Britain, Paul Theroux's Kingdom by the Sea, which I've also read, but which I remember is going to be quite a dyspeptic book, and a couple of people I know reviewed it, and they were quite sort of cross about it because, you know, surely it's not as grim as all that. And I just have wondered, were you reading it as you went round?
No, I had read it, and yeah. I do refer to it a couple of times in the book because it was so, at that time particularly, it was so much the sort of quintessential American view, outsider's view on Britain. And it is in many ways a fantastic book, but I made some decisions about how I was going to go about my book by reading that book and deciding to go in slightly different directions from Paul Theroux. One of the things you touched on, it was I tried to not be as dyspeptic as he, as he was, to be a little bit more positive than he was. That was my instinct anyway. But the other one was that I really decided that the one thing I wouldn't do is try to be encyclopedic. That I think that was, it just seemed to me that that's a failing of lots of travel books. Failing isn't perhaps the right word, but it's a problem with travel books because, you know, once you've done two or three or four declining northern industrial cities, there isn't really a need to go to a fifth and sixth one. And if you're just going, trying to go everywhere, then I think it becomes a little bit repetitious. So both in the new book, The Little Dribbling, and in Notes from a Small Island, I mean, I was very selective. Lots and lots of places aren't in either one of those books. Places that I perhaps, you know, would have been obvious candidates to go to, like Bath or Stratford-on-Avon. But I tended to leave them out and to choose kind of archetypal type places. So I focused more like on one or two seaside places, one or two industrial towns, that sort of thing.
Right, okay. I mean, it must have been quite difficult reading both your books, and especially with your passionate feelings about, you know, planning cock-ups and idiocies, and, you know, which I think is shared by your readers. That's one of the reasons Notes from a Small Island is such a much-loved book, because I think a lot of these feelings and passions are shared. You know, how could you put that there, sort of thing. It must be, did you have to consciously try not to represent places as always kind of not being as nice as they must once have been, if you see what I mean? That you go round places and they've always, all the changes that have, I know people who see all British towns as being, having been spoiled compared to what they once were.
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think the way I go through life is always hoping that wherever I'm going, whether I'm writing, doing it for pleasure or for writing a book, is that I'm going to have a happy experience, that I'm going to be delighted with what I see. And very often I am. And in both of these books that we're discussing here, there are plenty of places I thought were, you know, quite delightful and were very pleasant surprises and I was enchanted with. But equally, if I feel, you know, obliged, if I go to a place and it's Bradford, I have to be frank about it. And you know, if in some way it is a disappointment. What I particularly ranted on about in Notes from a Small Island was places that are beautiful and ought to be beautiful throughout, being spoiled. I went on a lot about Oxford.
Yes.
I mean, Oxford was then, and it's much improved now, I think, but it was then still, you know, and wonderful, beautiful city. It had some glorious architecture and the nicest streets to walk along anywhere in the world. But it was spoiled lots by, you know, ugly, thoughtless 1960s buildings that didn't have any purpose being there. The sort of buildings that the British Telecom used to put up everywhere. And those kinds of things. So it makes me cross when I see them in a place like Oxford where they shouldn't be allowed at all.
I wonder if sometimes in Notes from a Small Island, some of the places which seem most interesting to you and therefore really interesting to the reader are those places which are almost attractive because of a slightly melancholy sense of lost glories, which is a rather different thing from having great concrete. Morecambe I've never been to, but after rereading Notes from a Small Island, I really rather did want to go there.
I mean, they're all individual cases. Morecambe's a sad case, I think, because it is still quite a lovely place. I mean, there's a lot of really nice houses along the seafront, and it has the most fabulous setting of any town I could think of, a coastal setting in Britain. I mean, you're looking right across Morecambe Bay, which is fantastically beautiful, and you're seeing the Lake District as your backdrop. I mean, it'd be hard to find something more attractive than that. And yet here it is, this failing, rather dreary town that is depressing to be in because it's failing. I mean, there's just no escaping that. So my feeling there was, you know, I wish they could do something about this. I wasn't angry or anything. I was just kind of saddened by it. And it just seems strange to me that that's true of so many seaside places. I don't really quite understand why that should be, because you would think those would be ideal places. I mean, you know, it's right next to Lancaster. Lancaster has a university. It must have quite a vibrant economy with lots and lots of, you know, young academics and things like that. Why don't they move to Morecambe, buy these houses and fix them up? Why doesn't it stop trying to be a seaside resort of the type that really died 20, 25 years ago?
I was thinking about what were the things about your book which made people think, oh, yes, this is us. Because, of course, it's not places, it's people as well. And I was thinking about a vignette. I don't know if you remember it, Bill, but you give it a certain importance, actually, in Notes from a Small Island, which is, stays with me, because I've seen these people, but I mean, not exactly the same people. A couple wrapped in blankets, mostly, sitting on a beach, but in front of their beach hut. It's interesting that, I don't know if you're conscious of this now, but it's the bit in Notes from Small Island which actually sends you off into quite a kind of reverie about the happiness of living in Britain, as if this couple who are sort of, I don't know, got a thermos flask or something. No, they've got a kettle in the beach hut that they've can got, retire. It's blinking chilly, but they look as though they might be in Corfu or something.
Yeah, well, I was using it. They looked as if they were very, very happy, and because they had a beach hut, and it was on a beach at Christchurch in Dorset, And it was a foul day. I can remember walking along the beach and it was, you know, leaning into this wind with sand being driven into my face. And all the beach huts along the front there were closed up for the winter, except there was this one that was open. And this couple were sitting out in front of it with all the hatches open and everything. And they were there with lap blankets on. And the man was trying to read a newspaper, and the wind really was wrapping it around his face. And it just, I mean, it was the most challenging possible conditions to be happy and comfortable. And they were clearly, transparently failing at it. And yet they were happy as anything, because this is the British when they're relaxing. And I love that. I mean, I genuinely love and admire that business of liking small pleasures and really making the most of little things. And for years and years, it did really mystify me, because I come from America. And if you're going to have fun in America, you know, you have to invest a lot of money and buy equipment and jump out of airplanes or things. And here, you know, it's so much simpler. And I remember, I genuinely remember that I was sitting in a dreary cafe on a seaside promenade one day, like in March, and I ordered a cup of tea, a toasted tea cake, and when they brought them to me, I said, "Ooh, lovely." And, and I knew then I'd gone over to the other side.
You know? Come over.
And seriously, ever since then, I thought, it is one of the most attractive features of the British, is that they aren't so easy to please, and I mean that in an entirely admiring way.
I mean, there are some, we've got one or two other traits here, which you obviously relish, but I just wonder how relishable they actually are if you're British. I mean, one particular thing which produces some really funny bits actually in your new book as well, which explains to all readers, I suspect for the first time, how the what's laughably called the system of labelling A and B roads works in Britain. And honestly, the road to Little Dribbling's worth the cover price for that
oh, I'm so glad
section
you
alone.
That. Thank you.
But that habit, you know, I think I can share in confidence for everybody here that my mother-in-law once had a sort of boyfriend whose conversation was always, "Well, if you cut through the B237 and then loop round by the little known A15 bypass and then take your third right by Tesco's, you can actually save a full 3 minutes, you know." But
it's absolutely true, and we've all had this experience. If you're in a pub and men are having that conversation, every single one of them will be nodding when someone mentions, you know, the grit box outside, you know, Bury St. Edmunds or something. Everybody knows every feature of the landscape.
So why is that? Why the rat discussion of routes? Because I can feel it. I can feel it, particularly as the years roll past. I can feel it coming on me too.
I mean, I haven't the least fucking idea.
Well, maybe it's all that small island thing. Everybody has to know every little bit. Maybe it's just a sort of a way of showing, way we have of showing our sort of loving knowledge of the land in which we live.
Maybe it is a fact that the British, I think this is particularly true of British men, and particularly in pubs, there's nothing that gives them more pleasure than to discuss the best way to get from here to somewhere else.
Yeah. And there's another one which I think irks you, actually, in the book, at least, which is, I think you're in Ludlow, which is a beautiful place, although kind of everything tends to be a bit closed, maybe, and you're wandering around, and there's a cat, is it the Cat Protection League, the most particularly impressive building,
is
the headquarters of the Cat, not the local philosophical society, but the Cat Protection League. And as soon as I read this, I thought, God, that is absolutely true. I know places where the best building in town is the sort of the donkey sanctuary headquarters or the... And this is a peculiar thing about us, apparently.
The British and the love of animals is something that I don't entirely share. I mean, I'm on the record in one of my other books as suggesting that I wouldn't be the least bit disturbed if all the dogs on the planet were rounded up and put in some large sack and taken to some distant place like Greenland and just left there. Except poodles. Poodles I would shoot.
Well, I think that's a testimony, Bill, to your readers' love of you, because I've never known anyone in Britain before express hatred of dogs and get a round of applause. A muted round, but a round.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace. If you want to build a website, you have many options. But if you want to build it beautiful, there's only one. Squarespace gives you the power of world-class design, so you can do more than create a website. You can set yourself apart. See why some of the world's most influential people, brands, and businesses choose Squarespace. To start your free trial, visit squarespace.com/guardian.
There are obviously lots of traits of Britishness that you appreciate or relish, or even if they're absurd, you enjoy them. I guess the thing about Britain that you seem to kind of, in some ways, love the most, which kind of punctuates Notes from a Small Island with these sort of, actually quite sort of rhapsodic moments, is views. And I remember I had an aunt and uncle once who used to get out maps where, and they had special kind of maps where views were marked. I think Ordnance Survey maps actually mark views, and they mark how many degrees round the view is. And sometimes you get the 360 degree. And they would just on weekends go from one view to another. And I always thought that was a bit silly. And reading Notes from a Small Island, I think actually maybe they're onto it. Maybe that is actually the top thing that one could do.
Well, it's a great reward that you get when you go out into the countryside, that you see all of these fantastic things. I do think, I say this at some length in the new book, because I really do genuinely think the greatest achievement of the British nation is the countryside. It's because it's entirely accidental. Nobody planned it, and nobody, you know, intended it to look like this sort of spectacular parkland, but it does almost everywhere you go, almost without fail, wherever you are. You know, if you stand on a hillside and look out, you get a great view. And it's not just a pleasing view. It's actually a world-class view, more often than not. And that's something that I think the British take for granted, and it's something that I worry about a lot and touch on in a worried tone in my new book, because there is a danger in taking it for granted, that everybody sees it as... politicians of both sides seem to see it as this sort of underdeveloped resource, the countryside, that it's not actually paying its way somehow, that it really needs to be developed and put to use. As I say in the book, I think the view seems to be that the countryside is very fine until it's needed for something else. And I do find that a very worrying thing, and I wish they would stop it.
I think one of the things about Notes from a Small Island that is one of its special qualities, is that you're sometimes quite irascible in it, and irascible about, you know, people who irritate you, sort of 10-year-old boys who pick their nose on the train, or, he's the one I remember.
It's not a theme running through the book, though, is it?
Or the couple who tell you all about the horrors of American English, whom I can hear very, very clearly now. Or somebody in McDonald's who asks you if you want an apple turnover when you haven't asked for one.
No, yes, if I wanted fries for that, which always drives me crazy.
And was that, I'm just thinking about how self-conscious you were writing it, whether that sense, which is a kind of wonderful sense when you read the book, of... You get your ruminations, you get your bits of bad temper, you get your bits of kind of where you're sort of almost euphoric, and you get all of that. Whether that simply is how it came up in the recollection of your journey, or whether you sort of
thing that's different when I write a book about Britain is that if I write a travel book about Australia, it's me being 100% a traveler in Australia. I'm discovering Australia. When I write a book about Britain, I'm writing a book about the place where I live. So I'm not discovering it at all, really. All the things I see, nothing surprises me along the way. So really what I'm writing about is essentially my life in this country, looking at it. The basic thing I'm doing, the basic act I'm engaged in throughout both of these books is really trying to answer the question, what is it about this place that I love so much? Why do I stay here? What is it that keeps me here? And I really am very, very happy here. And most of the time, I think I'm writing about things, by and large, things that I'm happy about, or things that I think are terrific, but might be threatened, like the countryside. So, but occasionally, as in any place, my life is not 100%, happiness every waking moment. And occasionally, I do see things that befuddle or make me irascible. And those are often the things that people remember, because those make the funnier passages in the book. Me being angry or having run-ins with young men at McDonald's because why did they ask you if you want fries? if you didn't ask for fries, why did they ask you if you want fries? Do they think I'm incapable of remembering whether I want fries or not?
Well, it's also true, isn't it, that perhaps the most memorable conversation to me in Notes on a Small Island is the bit where you're reflecting upon meeting people on public transport. The fact that if somebody wants to talk to you on public transport in Britain, you know you're in trouble, really. And it's a bit, I mean, there's something very true about it. It's a bit like in 18th century novels. I used to specialise in 18th century novels in my academic life. And in an 18th century novel, if you go into a coaching inn and somebody engages you in conversation, it means in the novel that either, at best, they're the town bore and nobody else will talk to them, and at worst, they're going to rob you and strip you and leave you in a ditch, you know. But there's a very memorable conversation in a train in Notes from a Small Island with somebody who loves trains, which is a very cautionary and...
As I recall, we were riding along the River Severn, so I referred to him as the Severn Boar, which rather pleased me, if not your audience. But I mentioned this in the book, is that, you know, the one thing I don't do well at all is interact with people. I mean, one of the things I very much admire about Paul Theroux is that he engages with people everywhere. I mean, he has long conversations and gets... you know, really great material. And every time I do that, I get the most boring man in the world, or the person who doesn't speak English, or, you know, somebody who's completely just obviously an escaped lunatic or something. I'm just terrible at it. So my posture normally when I do these travel books is not to be a participant, but just to be an observer.
So in the many, many evenings in the book, when you're in a pub, nursing your pint of beer, you weren't having lots of conversations with people.
No, I have tried at times, but by and large, no. And in Britain, that doesn't happen, really. I mean, you know, if you were in a strange town and you went into a pub to just have a drink, you wouldn't probably fall into conversation with other people in the pub. I mean, it just doesn't happen here. It's more likely to happen in America, where people would approach you and it's not really a matter of friendliness. I think it's more respect here for privacy, that people let you have your space, which I like. So what I end up doing when I'm in pubs or a place like that is I tend to just eavesdrop on conversations. And that's what you get in the book. It's not me being part of the conversation, but me just listening to what's going on, or just looking around. Or because I don't have anybody to talk to, I tend to look at, you know, the fittings, or the pictures or whatever.
Well, my last question before I throw it open to everybody here. That's one thing that sort of fascinated me about the difference, but perhaps I'm wrong, between writing the journey that you undertook for Notes from a Small Island and the journey you undertook for The Road to Little Dribbling, which is, I would have imagined that for your new book, weren't there people going, that's a Bill Bryson bloke?
No, it hardly ever happens. It's a strange thing. Honestly, it doesn't happen. It certainly doesn't happen to me. I have had been a few times when I've been like on the underground with one of my kids or something, and they'll say to me, when we get off, that man across from you was looking at you. Yeah. But if I look up, he looks away. But I think by and large, writers don't get recognized. I mean, you know, they just, we're pretty anonymous people, and that's as true of me as it is of... But just think, I mean, how many other writers that you wouldn't necessarily recognize if you saw them walking down the street? What happens with me, this is a true story I have to tell you, but is that people see someone else and think it's me. I just have to tell you this story because it's absolutely true. I got a letter not so long ago from a woman named Margaret, and she said to me, "Dear Mr. Bryson, I was recently at Bristol Temple Mead Station on the platform with my friend Brenda. And we fell into conversation with an American gentleman there, and he had a ginger beard and a bit of a paunch, and he was a nice man. We had a nice conversation, and when we parted ways, I said to Brenda, I said, do you know who that was? It was Bill Bryson. And Brenda said, no, it wasn't. And I said, yes, it was. And I'm now writing to you, Mr. Bryson, because I'd like you to write back to me and confirm so that I can put Brenda straight. Thank you very much. So I wrote back to her. I said, dear Margaret, I'm sorry to tell you that I haven't been through Bristol Temple Mead Station in some years, and I don't think I've ever actually been on the platform there. So whoever it was you were talking to, it wasn't me. But thank you very much for writing. Best wishes, Bill Bryson. And 3 or 4 days later, I swear to God, I got another letter from her. It said, "Dear Mr. Bryson, I don't understand why you're lying about this."
There's a lady right in the front row. Please.
Yeah, ever since I've read Down Under, because I was going to visit Australia 1 year and I thought, I've got to read this book. I was in absolute stitches into the fourth page. And I've always wanted to meet you because your wit is very acerbic. And I've just wanted to meet somebody who is so funny on the page. I just wondered if you're like that in real life.
No, honestly, I'm not. No, I remember when I wrote my first book that my brother read it. And he seriously said to me, read the book, and he said, "I didn't know you were funny." So, no, I'm not. I tend not to, you know, I'm not a performer. I'm like most writers, I'm fairly introverted. And again, part of the reason I sink into the shadows when I'm in a pub or place like that, I'm not a foreground kind of person. So, no, if you saw me at a dinner party or something, you wouldn't be thinking, what a lovely, delightful, enchanting fellow. So, I'm sorry.
My question is, what's next? I know you just finished a book, but always excited for your next book.
Well, thank you. And it's just a question I always love to hear when I've just finished a new one. Yeah? I mean, I've really only just finished this one. But I have, for a long time, I've been wanting to do a book sort of in the same spirit of a short history of nearly everything. And I'm going to do a book about the human body, but looking at it, obviously, from the perspective of someone who's totally ignorant about the science behind the human body, but looking at it as a machine. I've always found it fascinating that, as we're sitting here now, just think of all the systems inside you that are keeping you going, keeping you sitting upright and keeping your brain humming and all of that, all the hormones and everything that's coursing through your body. And I kind of find that amazing that how our body looks after us, even though most of us don't treat it particularly well. And yet, you know, it gives you at least, for most of us, 70 or so good years, even if you sort of abuse it. I think that's quite astonishing. So that's the next one.
Mr. Bryson, I should say that I come for Bognor Regis because someone someone has to. But I must also say that I thought the first bit about Bognor, I thought, Jan, he's right. You've got it absolutely spot on. But if you get the bus, the 700 bus, get the second one, it's a double decker. But well done. Bognor was superb.
Thank you.
And that was Bill Bryson speaking with John Mullen and members of the audience at the Guardian Book Club. For more information on Guardian live events, go to theguardian.com/membership. So from me, Susanna Tresillian, goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.